the exoticism and eroticism continues, and there are, I have to warn you, there are going to be a few pornographic images in my presentation today. So I'm going to talk about Tim Lindsky's Der König Kandaulis, which is based on André Gide's 1899 play, Le Roi Kandau. Zemlinsky was forced to flee Austria in 1938 for the usual reasons. He abandoned his work on the partially completed opera. It was completed in short score. And then the opera was completed by Anthony Beaumont in 1996 and premiered in Hamburg the same year. And it's been touring around Europe ever since in various forms. So there are a number of historical sources for the what we suppose were real historical events, which took place in Lydia in 716 BC. So all accounts agree on the basic facts, which is that Guges, I'm going to use the German pronunciation because we're going to listen to the opera, some of the opera later. Guges, who was a commoner, murdered the king of Lydia, Kandaulis, and seized the throne and married his dead king's wife, Nusia. The most famous account comes from Herodotus's Histories, and the centerpiece of Gide's play and Zemlinsky's opera is taken from that. So, here you can see a painting from 1646 of the Herodotus version. So Guges was the king's, in the Herodotus version, Guges was the king's bodyguard, and Kandaulis believed that his wife was the most beautiful woman on earth, and insisted on showing Guges her naked body. And fearing both the reaction of the queen and what the king would do to him afterwards, Guges was understandably reluctant to do this. Nevertheless, the king finally convinces him to do it, and gets him to hide behind a curtain in the royal bedchamber, and then wait for her to undress at bedtime. But the queen spots him, leaves the room, and swears to take revenge for the king and Guges impropriety. The next day she tells Guges that either he or the king must answer for the crime. Guges, not wanting to die himself, plots with the queen to murder the king. She gives him a knife, and he agrees to hide behind the same curtain, and then and kill the king when he sleeps. So we can see some French pictures from the 19th century here that André Gide may have seen. There's a more sort of academic style one closer to the time. In the Gide and the Zemlinsky opera, they've also taken a certain element, a moralistic element, from Plato's Republic. So Plato's major change to the play was the introduction of an invisibility ring, and the question of what a person would do if they were able to make themselves invisible, and how immoral they would be. Here's another picture from France, very close to the time the play was written. And then here's a very old and rare picture of the Plato version of the story. So in the Republic, Glaucon relates the myth, the ring of Guges. One day Guges, who now is not the bodyguard anymore, he's a shepherd, in the service of the king of Lydia, is grazing his sheep, when nearby an earthquake struck, opening up a crack in the ground. You can just about see the crack in the ground there. Inside, amongst other treasures, he discovered a ring on a dead nobleman inside a brass horse. That's a brass horse. And later, at a meeting of shepherds, he notices that when he turns the ring inwards, the others are no longer able to see or hear him. So he arranges things to go to the to give the shepherd's report to the king. And once he's there, he uses his power to seduce the queen and conspires with her to murder the king and take his place. And Glaucon's argument is that, in a similar situation, all of us would behave like Guges, in order to maximise our own advantage. It's only the fear of the disapproval of others and punishment that prevents us. For Glaucon, if a man had the power to act unjustly towards another in order to benefit himself and did not use it, he would be mad. This is the so-called immoralist or egoist theory of justice. And Socrates' counter-argument, to sum it up briefly, is that men act justly for the good of their soul. In the simplest possible terms, acting justly makes you happy. So there are various critical interpretations of both the book and the play that either come down on the kind of Glaucon view, the immoralist view, or they come down on the Socrates side, basically by siding with either Candaulis or Gyges. But the history of the play, which I'll talk about in a minute, shows that Gide's own position was much more complicated, much more ambiguous, in fact. And my claim is that Zemlinsky's music keeps the moral ambiguity of the piece intact by making us feel equal sympathy for both characters, Candaulis and Gyges. He paints them both in equally humane colours, inviting his audience to come to their own conclusions about the source of morality in a post-Christian or a post-Nietzschean world. So let's talk about Gide's play first. So as well as the Plato and the Herodotus, Gide's play also takes ideas from Justinius, Nicholas of Damascus, Ptolemy and Plutarch, who all recorded versions of the legend. Gide's Candaulis is imbued with the wealth of his ancestor Croesus, and he's surrounded by various flatterers and sycophants. Gyges is now a fisherman, and he has a wife, Trudo, and the ring is discovered at a fish that Gyges has caught at a feast organised by the king. Instead of the king's bodyguard, Gyges is now a childhood friend. And the chief innovation was to set up a tension between the king's desire to immodestly display his riches on the one hand and the implied power of concealment and secrecy and hiding on the other. This is demonstrated at the feast by the king's insistence that his wife, against her will, remove her veil so that his guests may share her beauty. It wasn't a success in France, and the 1905 translation by Franz Bly was a disaster in Germany. A view of the Vienna production, a reviewer of the Vienna production put his finger on the problem. It was too intellectual for a mystic experience, too far elevated above reality to be moving as a true-to-life drama. But it did still make a deep and powerful impression. So the play, which bears a lot of similarities to Oscar Wilde's Salome, which was published in French in 1893 and first performed in 1896, just 3 years before this play was written. The play, the Gide play, is so nebulous that it supports any a range of interpretations. And in his accompanying essay to the play, Gide put forward a communist reading in which the virtuous proletarian Gyges overthrows an effete bourgeois Candaulis. But as French critics have recently discovered, this was actually a cunning meta-artistic ruse designed to veil the real personal events that had inspired the play. Namely, that Gide had been forced to reveal his love affair with another man to a good friend of his with disastrous consequences. So very much like Wilde's Salome, there is a homosexual subtext running through the play, which the otherwise obscure motivations of the king and queen, through which the otherwise obscure motivations of the king and queen can be explained. So, on to the Zemlinsky version. This is Zemlinsky with his pupil Schoenberg. Zemlinsky's wife, Louise, chose the text. She used to go to the library and read plays that seemed to have potential and suggest them to him. It certainly contains all the magical and mystical elements that usually appeal to him. And after some initial skepticism, he decided to set it. What did he think about the play? Well, And why did he think it would be appropriate to set it at this particular time? No one has any idea. He doesn't say anything about it in his letters, and he didn't keep a diary. But the ease with which allegorical interpretations can be generated means that there's still been plenty of speculations. My favourite is Anthony Beaumont, the guy who completed the opera and has written a huge biography of Zemlinsky. His idea is my favourite, I think. In the erotic climax of the work, Candaulus gives Gugis the ring, and then while Gugis watches, Candaulus seduces his wife, blowing out all the candles as she removes her clothes and let down her hair. At this point, the king retreats from the scene and allows the invisible Gugis to step in and take over. In Beaumont's allegory, Candaulus becomes Zemlinsky, Gugis becomes Schoenberg, and Nucia personifies music. The idea is that Zemlinsky had revealed all the beautiful secrets of the Western tonal system to Schoenberg, and then he had and then been forced to stand back and watch in impotent horror as he defiled it. In this, in his meticulous and thorough investigation of the opera, Uwe Zommer has developed a more sophisticated and sensitive reading of the opera in terms of contemporaneous German and Austrian politics. Zommer argues, to simplify somewhat, that with his musically sympathetic Candaulus, Zemlinsky was intending to make a powerful artistic statement against the immoralist position in which the Germany of the 1930s had morphed, that is, a quasi-Darwinian might is right foreign policy and eugenicist social policy. But this reading is also problematic, especially given Gide's own communist interpretation. Surely Gugis cannot simultaneously stand for the might is right doctrine of the fascists and the legitimate proletarian revolt against a corrupt bourgeoisie, especially when fascism only gained a foothold in Italy, Germany and Spain because it was funded by a corrupt bourgeoisie scared of a proletarian revolution. This underlies the difficulty with any semiotic reading. If the interpretation and reality fit together nicely in one place, they are sure to contradict each other in another. So, I would argue that the myth, as told by Gide and Zemlinsky, is a counterfactual thought experiment, a delusion machine, if you like, designed to get one thinking about the nature of morality, and so it can never be forced into one simple one-to-one allegory. And there are two ways in which it does this. Firstly, Gide's version of the tale is an inversion of Vladimir Propp's well-known morphology of the folk tale. Everything that happens is the reverse of the way it's set out in Propp's scheme. And secondly, Gide gives us two opposing forms of masculinity. The king, who is effeminate and decadent, and Gugis, who has all the hallmarks of the traditional male, silent, prepared to use aggression and violence to advance his cause when necessary. So, unlike Strauss in Salome, who enfeebles his male characters, Yorkanon and Herod, equally in favour of the female character Salome, Zemlinsky humanises both his male characters and refuses to establish a hierarchy between the two. So, I want to talk about the musical characterization of the play in the opera between the two male characters. So there's an obvious timbral distinction between the two male lead roles. Gugis is a baritone and Candaulus is a tenor. On top of this, in both the commercially available recordings, tenors have been chosen who are evidently straining in a higher register of F to A. So let's talk about Gugis first. For the most part, Gugis's speech consists of direct, factual statements. This is mirrored in music with straight rhythmic figures, accompanied by uncluttered, simple orchestration. The vocal line is diatonic, it traces out triads, so there's a predominance of thirds and fourths, octaves, and most prominently descending fifths, giving a sense of finality to his factual statements. This fifth in the vocal line allows Zemlinsky to avoid the cliché 5-1 perfect cadence in the harmony, but most of the chords are still simple major or minor triads, sometimes with an added seventh. So let's listen to a bit of Gugis' musical characterization. So this is the end of the final scene four of Act One. So after finding the gold ring in the fish, Candaulis summons Gugis to the table. This is what we hear. Zemlinsky's turning him into a very sympathetic character. King runs onto the stage in Salome, always Salome, always the princessin. The word of the king should be law, and yet his words have no purchase. Salome does not do what she's commanded to do. And how does Strauss's music create this effect? There's a lot of energy in the music. Tetrarch's vocal line whizzes up and down, imitated in the violins, but it doesn't seem to go anywhere. It's done with whole tone scales and whole tone harmonies, without any hierarchy of tones or chords. There's no destination for music to move towards and to feel as if it's arrived. So it sounds like so much huffing and puffing. Zemlinsky does something similar for Candaulis, except that he does it in a much more nuanced way, because he wants to give his character an alternative style of masculinity, more of an aesthetic, reflective kind of masculinity, rather than simply impotent or ineffective. So on his first appearance, Candaulis sings a solitary, substantial aria. The text paints him as a decadent, interested most of all in sensual pleasures, the fragrances of flowers or the sweetness of the sorbets. He also introduces his fatal flaw. He enjoys those sensual pleasures twice as much if he can share them with others. He not only uses long, flowery, metaphorical sentences, he also keeps repeating himself. So let's listen to how Zemlinsky goes about doing that, going about setting that.
Thank you.
long twisting sentences are repeated in Zelensky's vocal line. Instead of a sequence of arches that move towards a climactic high note, he circles around, alternating between high and low register in an unpredictable manner. So the phrases might be U-shaped or corkscrew-shaped. Kandalas' motif does not occur as such in this passage, but most phrases are encompassed within his characteristic unstable minor ninth or major seventh intervals, the opposite of Gugis' stable fifths and octaves. For the most part, the vocal line is bathed in a sumptuous four-part polyphony. We heard the strings in the background during that section there. But although the overall chord progression makes sense in terms of ordinary functional harmony, a circuitous route is taken between the dominant and the eventual tonic, which is not heard until many bars later. And then later on in this music that I played, when he goes into a reverie, the bass line disintegrates into nothingness, an important part of his characterization. It's Gugis who becomes invisible, but it's Kandalas who always seems liable to musically disappear. So, whereas Strauss gave the king vacuous, unsympathetic music corresponding to his selfish desires, Zelensky's Kandalas has a depth of feeling that's never in doubt, and so he comes across as a much more sympathetic character. So, all the sex and violence takes place in the first and third acts, but it's the second act, which is more psychological in nature, and that's when the shift in power really takes place. It consists of two long exchanges, one between Kandalas and Gugis, and then between Kandalas and Nusia. In the first of these, the longest scene in the opera, Kandalas plays an elaborate psychological game with Gugis. In terms of the plot, the purpose of Act 2 is to motivate Gugis' actions in Act 3, murdering the king and taking over the realm. Kandalas employs a double-pronged attack in this scene. On the one hand, he tries to tempt Gugis by introducing him to his sensual pleasures, beautiful music, fine clothes, fine wines, and at the end of the act, the vision of his fully unveiled wife. On the other, he tries to provoke resentment and jealousy by revealing the full extent of his riches and his territory. And by suggesting that Gugis only killed his wife, he killed his wife in the first act, should have mentioned that earlier, because he glimpsed the far more beautiful Nusia and was jealous. However, the idea that Kandalas is using emotional trickery to bend Gugis to his will, as it initially seems, becomes untenable. Although the integrity of the two characters and their individual brand and musical masculinity remains broadly intact, both emerge from the same coherent musical nexus. The scene is heard, therefore, as an emotional interaction between the two, in which the desires of the self become intimately bound up with sympathy and resentment towards the other. So at the end of the scene, Kandalas finally convinces Gugis to put on the magic ring and to stay. In the next scene, he gradually blows out the candles while getting his wife to disrobe and let down her hair. Over the course of the two scenes, there's a large-scale reenactment of the tendency of the king to disappear that we would have heard in this aria. The equality of their presence in the musical texture is part of an ongoing process that at the end of the act sees the king initially in a position of dominance fade away to nothing and Gugis finally step into his place. So I want to conclude by suggesting that, you know, Ede and Zelensky are both writing after Nietzsche in this kind of post-Christian sense, and of course Ede's more famous, The Immoralist, which you might have heard of, explores this kind of idea of just doing, you know, the Nietzschean noble morality in more detail. So, but the important thing is that Nietzsche's slave noble morality is a heuristic device. It's much misunderstood. Moral nets are imposed over the moral nets that are imposed over the noble are what makes society interesting, according to Nietzsche. They're what make human beings an interesting animal. So if we just followed our instincts, everything worthwhile would not exist, society in any meaningful sense, art, philosophy, science, etc. Nevertheless, the point is that the will to tear up moral norms is necessary sometimes to shake up the order when morals are constricting life, freedom, or creativity. So what I would suggest that Gide and Zelinsky are doing in their versions of the Socratic myth is forcing their audience to think about how one breaks existing moral codes in productive and healthy ways. Thank you.